You're listening to the History Today podcast for April 2012. I'm Dean Nicholas, web manager at History Today. In this month's edition, who killed Alexander the Great?
And then he reports the rival theory that Alexander had gotten ill after drinking a cup of wine at a banquet and crying out as if stabbed in the back with a sudden pain.
James Rom weighs up new evidence about the mysterious death of the revered Macedonian ruler. Also in this edition, John Guy reassesses the relationship between Thomas Becket and Henry II, and, 30 years after the conflict broke out, Patrick Bishop recalls his experiences as a foreign correspondent with the British task force sent to reclaim the Falklands. First up, History Today editor Paul Lay speaks to James Rom about the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC, the subject of the cover story in our April issue.
I wonder if you could tell us, James, just for those who haven't read the article and are not familiar, what we actually do know for sure, for certain, about the circumstances of Alexander's death.
Well, very little for certain, I'm afraid, because the sources on Alexander all date from two or more centuries after his death. The contemporary sources have all perished, so we're dealing with second-hand information, sometimes third-hand information, and those sources are at variance with each other. So right away, the evidence is very confusing and problematic from antiquity. And then in the modern world, the research that's been done has taken many different paths, but the two basic paths are those of disease versus poison. And the scholars, historians are very much divided on those two theories. Did he die of disease or was he poisoned?
And why have we come to those two possibilities? Why have historians arrived at those two?
Well, those are the two that are already being debated by the sources in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. The account of Plutarch, for example, in Plutarch's Life of Alexander, discusses his death by illness, and then attacks the rival theory that he was killed by poison. So already Plutarch was aware of these two possibilities and was at pains to support one over the other.
And where did Plutarch stand?
He was very much on the side of illness. Mm-hmm. He reports a fever that progressed over 10 or 11 days and finally led to a comatose state. And then he reports a rival theory that Alexander had gotten ill after drinking a cup of wine at a banquet and crying out as if stabbed in the back with a sudden pain. And he says that that can't be true and that it's invented by people who want to make the story as dramatic as possible.
Now
you have it. You have the two rival theories combating each other right there in the 2nd century AD.
And what's quite interesting, and it's a point that you make in the article, is that although Oliver Stone's film, his film biopic of Alexander, didn't receive so many critical plaudits, it nevertheless did base itself on some pretty cutting-edge scholarship and was aware of the current debate on the historiography of Alexander's death.
Yes, that's right. Stone portrays the poisoning theory and stays fairly close to the sources as to how the poisoning occurred and who was responsible. He makes a coterie of officers responsible, all of them close to the king in his last days, and even gives them a motive, which is the same motive that some modern scholars would give them, namely that they didn't want to press on to a new campaign. Alexander was determined to keep pressing onward with new conquests, and his generals simply didn't want to follow him any further.
And who were these generals? Who were these key figures who would have been the culprits of those who suspected there was poisoning?
Well, Ptolemy was one of the principals. Ptolemy, who later ended up king of Egypt and started the Ptolemaic dynasty there. And Stone, of course, makes Ptolemy the narrator of his film and has Ptolemy directly take responsibility for Alexander's death at the end of the movie, in the final sequence. Then there were also men like Cassander, who was not one of the top generals, had been in Europe during all of Alexander's conquests, but came to Babylon and met with Alexander just before his death. And that circumstance led a lot of people to suspect that he had brought poison with him from Europe and poisoned Alexander on behalf of his father, Antipater. That was the principal theory about who was responsible for the poisoning right from antiquity onward.
When we're dealing with Alexander, he's one of the most mythologized figures in all of history. So we have this lack of real sources there and lost in the distant past, as well as this accretion of centuries of mythology there. It makes it particularly difficult to see through that, I would imagine, for historians. Have they been helped in any way by advances in science that have affected history in any sense?
It's possible they have. It's too soon to tell because a lot of the research is very, very recent. And in fact, the most plausible theory in my mind is one that is currently being developed and published by a toxicologist in New Zealand who has matched up Alexander's reported symptoms with those of hellebore poisoning. And that's fascinating because hellebore was in fact a medicinal drug in the ancient world, but an overdose of it could be fatal, could produce the kind of coma that Alexander fell into, according to the sources. So hellebore could have been administered as a medicine, but in a too large a dose, or perhaps Alexander himself stepped up the dose in order to cure himself and inadvertently poisoned himself. So there you have a new theory, which is neither poisoning nor illness, but something sort of in between.
And what could you present us with a picture of what that court was like? Again, it's one of these things that's surrounded by myth. We've seen Hollywood's versions of Alexander's life time and time again. But what was the nature of the court there?
I believe it was a cadre of loyal and highly devoted officers, since I don't believe ultimately that they poisoned him. I believe that they were devoted to his cause and believers in his vision of a world empire stretching from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean, basically, and saw themselves as the heirs or the closest in power to the king, and therefore would benefit hugely from his administration of that empire.
And you would
they had everything to gain from his survival and much to lose from his death.
And this idea of this great empire from the Atlantic into Central Asia, they seemed to be very aware that they were building this. It wasn't just something that accrued. There was a sense of mission about it in some way. Is that correct?
I think so. Again, the sources are somewhat at variance, but to my reading, Alexander had very firm plans for who was going to rule the empire, how it was going to be administered, and especially how he was going to fuse European and Asian cultures so as to create a kind of world state. That was his agenda that only his closest followers firmly supported. The rest of the army and the middle rank officers had grave doubts about it.
And he was very certain about this, that it could be achieved, and of course it ultimately was achieved.
Yes, well, the empire stayed intact only for a few years and then fragmented into pieces, a story that's told in my book, Ghost on the Throne. But in some sense, it did maintain the kind of global world culture, mixed culture, that Alexander had envisioned, in that European monarchies were blended, often by intermarriage, with local populations.
Was there any precedent for what Alexander had done, or what his ultimate achievement was?
No, none whatsoever. This was the first time that Europe and Asia had been held together in a single political entity. They had always been at odds before his time, so it was really a revolutionary move to try to bridge the gap between the continents.
And was it something that was dependent chiefly on the force of personality of Alexander, who's obviously an extraordinary figure? And how much did he owe to the organization of the Macedonian kingdom and the relationships with others?
Well, the Macedonians had been friends to the Persian kingdom for a couple of centuries before Alexander's time. In fact, they had more or less been allies of the Persians at the time when the Persians invaded Greece in 480 BC. So they were familiar with the idea of a large aggregate empire combining many peoples, centralized but with subdivisions in many different parts of Asia. They had seen all that in action, and they'd had Persians at their own court. So in some ways, they stepped into the footsteps of the Achaemenids, the Persian rulers, who had carved out the path for a worldwide empire.
Why did it fall apart so spectacularly and so quickly?
Well, that's the story that Ghost on the Throne tries to tell. It's a very complicated story, but to put it in a nutshell, Alexander died without a successor or any plan for succession. He died at 32 at a time when he was healthy and at the peak of his power. It didn't seem that he had any reason to need a successor, and he hadn't yet appointed one or engendered one. He did have a baby in utero at the time that he died, but of course much too young to hold power after he was born. And his only other male relative was a mental invalid, his half-brother. So the two of them together were made joint kings, neither one of them able to rule, and a board of regents was set up to administer the empire in their name, and things started to come apart very quickly.
And so to come back to this ultimate question of what was the cause of Alexander's death, I mean, you come down on the side of disease, largely, in terms of the evidence. Are we likely to discover much more? Are we ever likely to have a certain answer to it, do you think?
I don't think so. And in fact, the two foremost experts in the field in recent decades both ultimately gave up on trying to answer the question of what killed Alexander. They both said it was not knowable with all the sophisticated historical inquiry that's been done. So I think it's ultimately a matter for speculation, but the probability lies strongly on the side of disease.
Well, thank you, James. It's a fascinating article, and it's the cover story of April's History Today. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Next, John Guy discusses the life of Thomas Becket, the troublesome priest of Henry II. He talks to Paul Lay.
What I wanted to ask about that first, John, is why you returned to that period in a way. Because we do know you as a Tudor historian, that's how you've become established. What prompted you to go there?
What prompted me was I'd actually done this as a student, and for a while I was a research fellow in Cambridge, I'd actually taught it. Although I've taken a break from it for 30-odd years, it's always been a gleam in my eye to actually unpick the whole of the Becket story and just go back to the original sources. But what in particular prompted me to do it now was finishing the book, Daughter's Love and the Relationship of Moore and His Daughter. I realised how important Becket was as a saint in London, in the early 16th century, how particularly central he was in the life of not just Thomas More, but also More's original patron, Cardinal Morton. And of course, the resonances with Henry II and Becket's story and the confrontation between More obviously wasn't an archbishop, he wasn't even ordained, but there are resonances here, and I just wanted to explore this.
Yeah.
But the thing is that whereas, of course, More was a brilliant intellectual and scholar all the way through, Becket was a late developer. And in fact, he only got his foot on the ladder through nepotism. He had a posh education. He was sent to a good London grammar school. He went to the University of Paris. He didn't finish the course, as far as we can tell. He was an apprentice. He was a clerk to a banker, a London banker. That didn't work for him. Really, through a family connection, he entered Archbishop Theobald's household. Now, it was there that, in fact, he was able to rise up the ladder. And something just clicked, I think, with Theobald. Becket was always smart. He was, I think he was a bit lazy. He was an underachiever, but he had great potential. He was a very good talker. He'd had a stammer in his youth, and I think in the way that people overcome a stammer through a measured way of speaking, he became extremely articulate, and he was fleet of foot. And of course, Theobald was a plodder when it came to speeches and public events. Theobald, although he ended up a kingmaker, really wanted to be a pastoral figure. Of course, the civil war of Stephen's reign threw him into the limelight in a big way. And Becket became, in a nutshell, his fixer and right-hand man. That was how he first came to meet Henry.
Yes. And I wonder if you could say something about that period, just to set that context of Becket's life.
Henry I intended his daughter Matilda to succeed to the throne, but it's rather like with Mary Tudor, or even Elizabeth, the whole business of the resistance of barons or nobles to rule by a woman cuts in. Stephen gets the throne, and essentially there's a struggle for the throne that essentially lasts 19 or odd years. It doesn't cut in right away, but essentially there's this hiatus. Now, in the course of that, one of the big clashes that Theobald has with Stephen is when Stephen wants to crown his eldest son Eustace as his successor, and Theobald is not prepared to do that. Becket goes to Rome to actually get this forbidden by the Pope, so he gets experience there. But then Theobald, Eustace dies unexpectedly, suddenly. Theobald effectively sees, Stephen behaves in such a way, and his barons behave such a way in pillaging the church and sort of stealing its assets, that Theobald comes to take the view that Stephen is a tyrant. And in fact, in the process, he politicizes the archbishopric. Very few people knew, I didn't know when I started this book, that at the height of the crisis, Theobald was chased down the Thames by 12 angry knights, in a different boat, with their swords drawn. We know about this from the Beck Abbey Chronicle. And could easily actually have been assassinated, not in his own cathedral, but he could certainly have been assassinated just as Becket was. So these were really tense moments.
At the very heart of the Becket story is his relationship with Henry II. Now, what we have here is a very different telling from we've talked about the one, the Jean Henry film, the play which became the film, and the general myth of this very close relationship, this deep friendship at first between Henry II and Becket, and you blow that out the water.
Well, I certainly raised doubts about it, One of the things you have to know is that, of course, there are wonderful sources for the Becket story. I mean, Becket left something like 230 letters, although these are really from the period, almost apart from 10 when he was Archbishop. But, of course, there are also, this sort of dozen or so early biographies of Becket written by people who had known him in whole or in part, in some cases not really very well. But some of them, like William Fitzstephen or Herbert of Bosham, who'd been his clerks pretty much all the way through, had known him, or in particular John of Salisbury, his biggest friend, but also his most candid critic. These people had known him all the way, or nearly all the way through. I mean, John, since a couple of 3 years after he went into Theobald's service. But all the same, there's a certain amount of crossover between all these lives. There was some copying, and Fitzstephen's is one of the first. And in a nutshell, the story that Becket and Henry were the sort of friends that we see in, for example, in that movie with Richard Burton, essentially comes out of William Fitzstephen, who says that they were almost like blood brothers. They were great friends. They worked together. They played together. They hunted together. They ate together. Henry would come to Becket's hall in the evening. He'd ride his horse into the hall. He'd sort of vault over the tables and come and sit with Becket. Actually, what's really interesting is that for all of that, for all of those generalizations, Fitzstephen doesn't really come up with any specific anecdote. There isn't a single anecdote of how this friendship actually worked in practice. In fact, the two stories that he tells are one in particular where Henry and Becket are riding out one day, and Becket's got this wonderful new cloak, expensive new cloak, and they see a beggar, and Henry says, "Oh, wouldn't it be great to give this beggar something? Why don't we give him a cloak?" And Becket says, "Oh yeah, it's a good idea. It's a worthy deed of charity, not thinking that Henry means his cloak. And in fact, Henry absolutely humiliates Becket, and almost a fight begins. And what this story shows, actually, is that Henry's using all the techniques of psychology of a strong king to assert his power and authority over a middle-class man who is not his social equal.
So the relationship wasn't quite as exceptional as we think it is in terms of them being equals. You know, there was no doubt about who was in control there. He was always in.
Absolutely. And of course, this is a theme that cuts it. What Arnold says about this social distance and Henry's, if you like, sorry, aristocratic snobbiness. And I mean, you know, I mean, we recognise that a little bit in the 21st century, but I mean in the 12th century, I mean, this was absolutely predominant. After things go wrong, Henry always says, "You're an upstart. You're the son of one of my villains, or one of my peasants. You know, I raised you from nothing. You know, dot dot dot. Why won't you do what I want?" This is his constant refrain. And you know, Becket actually is incredibly proud of his ancestry. There's one in one of his letters. He says, "You know, my parents, in their way, were honourable and you know, and hardworking, and I'm actually proud of them. You know, St. Peter was a, you know, I mean, was a the apostles were fishermen." You know, I mean, he's proud of his ancestry in his way. I also think that Londoners, it's the same for Thomas More. London is almost, not quite, but there are elements in the 12th century, as there are, and far more in the 16th century, of a self-governing city. There are aspects of that. And London is a meritocracy in a way that the rest of England is not. But even in the, you know, I mean, you know, I show in this book that Henry never actually said, "Who will rid me of this turbulent priest?" That was actually, it wasn't even Lord Lyttelton, as you know, academics, writers thought it was. Electronic searching aids come to your rescue here, and you can actually track it back a few years before that. But the fact is that, you know, there are three or four versions of what Henry actually said. And, you know, it runs on roughly along, you know, basically, who are these useless drones who clutter up, you know, my court, none of whom will basically, you know, deal with this difficult. And the word upstart, you know, is actually not in all the versions, but it's basically in, you know, in several of these versions. And that's how it ended.
And what's your judgment, having been immersed in Becket now, what's your judgment of him as a man and as a historical figure?
I think Becket has been traduced, actually. I mean, Becket was far from perfect. But the idea that, you know, he was simply an actor saint, that he was a pretender, that he was a man on the make, that he was too shrill, that he was a hypocrite and all of this. This can all be undermined. And in fact, actually, you can see how this sort of line, the Brits have been particularly tough on Becket. And this is for two reasons. You would expect, once Henry VIII had declared him retrospectively to be a traitor and, you know, dismantled the shrine, you would expect the whole Reformation polemic to be anti-Becket. But of course, another thing that I discovered when I was actually doing a Tudor piece of work, quite separately, but of course, naturally, it's in the book, is that at the time of the break with Rome and at the time of the executions of More and Fisher, Pope Paul III actually says that, well, Bishop Fisher is a proper saint because he dies for the faith, he dies for the substance, whereas, you know, he's a proper saint, unlike Thomas Becket, who just basically died for a sort of a wrangle over the positions of the Church of Canterbury.
That was John Guy on the life of Thomas Becket. Finally this month, Patrick Bishop recalls his time with the British task force sent to reclaim the Falkland Islands 30 years ago this month. He talks to Paul Lay.
Patrick, you established yourself, I think, at first covering the riots of 1981 as a journalist, and then also Northern Ireland, and I wondered how Northern Ireland, covering Northern Ireland and the riots, helped in some sense to what was to come in the Falkland Islands in 82.
It didn't in the slightest, I have to say. I can't think of anything that actually prepared me, but it's an interesting question nonetheless, because you'd have thought, covering Northern Ireland, which I'd done quite a lot of by that stage, you would have come into contact with the army a lot and know the army's ways, maybe even know some of the people that were on the task force, but that wasn't the case because the army had at that point withdrawn into its shell because of the way it was being portrayed. You know, I mean, even right across the newspaper media, certainly, including newspapers like the Times, you know, they were regarded with great suspicion as sort of an occupying force. So the the Sinn Féin propaganda machine had done a pretty good job. So they really didn't have any contact with Jonas. So that was the first time I'd really come to close quarters with them. And it was an interesting and revelatory experience. I was a good kind of, you know, conventional lefty working for the Observer and expected the army to be a combination of, you know, toffee-nosed officers ordering around lumpen proles, you know, who had never the choice but to join up. And it, you know, became apparent very quickly that wasn't the case, that it was much more complicated and that much more interesting than that, that soldiers were far more thoughtful people than I gave them credit for. And I think that was a learning curve for all the journalists on the Canberra. I went down on the Canberra with 40 Commando Royal Marines and two battalions of the Parachute Regiment.
So these are pretty elite groups you're with on this. You discovered, I mean, when had you discovered you were going to the Falklands?
Well, it was all very, very quick because the crisis, as people will recall, was amazingly sudden. And so the journalistic arrangements were pretty sudden as well. I immediately volunteered. As soon as I heard about it, I thought, oh, they're sending troops, I want to go. So I volunteered. The MOD for once actually managed to move with some alacrity. And so you were kind of, once you got your name down, that was it. The people subsequently, bigger names, far bigger names than myself, then tried to bigfoot me, as the phrase was. But, you know, it was down there on the MOD's list. I was on the list and that was it. And there was nothing we could do about it.
And this was for the Observer?
This was for the Observer, yeah.
And did you have any training at all? Did you get any sense from the MOD of what was going to happen or what you might be involved with? Or were you just left on your own to a certain extent?
Well, there was there was a lot of time on the way down because the voyage was stop and start. We spent a lot of time sailing around Ascension Island because the diplomacy was going on. So this fleet was actually moving slowly southwards, and it was a kind of threat as well as a kind of diplomatic threat as well as being an actual military threat. And so we had loads of time to get fit, learn all the kind of basic, you know, military lore about first aid, you know, how to deal with a sucking chest wound, all delivered with great relish, as you can imagine, by these military instructors dealing with a load of lily-livered hacks. But by the end, we were firing weapons and we were in pretty good shape by the time we got there.
So you were there, when you say firing weapons, you were actually taking on a military role in some sense?
Well, no, we were just doing, you know, test firing with an SLR rifle off the back of the ship at targets, so they'd chuck out some old tin cans from the kitchen and then you would blast away at them, which was great fun. But there was a kind of, you know, we were very aware of our trying to protect our independent status. And so, you know, there's a debate about should we be wearing uniform, because we were official war correspondents, we were issued with uniform, we were given an honorary rank of captain and, you know, a little passport and everything. So you were very official. And so there's a kind of earnest debate about should we be letting the Argentinians know that we are not part of the invasion force, we are journalists. And so for a while there was a thought that we should sort of try and get our hands on some sort of colourful anoraks that would show that we were not soldiers. But when we relayed this to the military, they sort of fell about laughing, saying, well, you're very welcome to do that if you want. You know, the snipers on the Argentinian side would be very, very grateful to have the target illuminated in this way, you know. So that one went out of the window fairly rapidly, as indeed did any real sense of impartiality. I mean, I remember, you know, again, we were rather earnestly saying, you know, we've got to try and retain perspective and so forth, and, you know, we're not cheerleaders for the Mrs. Thatcher and the army and navy. But once you come under fire, you know which side you're on, and it pretty much stays like that. So that was on day one in San Carlos Water when the Argentinian Air Force were launching these incredibly brave raids, very low level, into the water and dropping bombs all around you. And you know, we found ourselves cheering as one sort of was hit by a missile and going down. So after that, it was rather hard to maintain the notion that you could keep any distance from this.
When you were making your way there to the Falklands, when on Canberra, did you get a sudden sense that, oh, this is war? Was there a sudden announcement that, yes, you know, this is going to be combat? And what were your thoughts then, thinking, oh, God, you know, this is for real. We're not involved in a diplomatic manoeuvre anymore.
Yeah, it was quite late in the day because there was so much to-ing and fro-ing at the UN. And it wasn't really till we were kind of quite deep in the South Atlantic that you suddenly thought, we're not turning around, you know, there's no turning around now. And it's quite thrilling, actually, it has to be said. You realise you're part of this enormous enterprise, you know, this it really was an epic. You look around you, you see all these, you know, grey hulls batting into these enormous South Atlantic waves, albatrosses skimming over. And, you know, you're kind of glad you're part of it because it's going to be a huge adventure. The death part, you're surrounded by other people who've got similar anxieties and fears, and so you kind of mutually, somehow without saying very much, people kind of mutually support each other. And of course, you know, the thing that sustains anyone in those circumstances, you don't want to be seen to let yourself down, so that sort of tends to help you deal with your concerns.
And what were your relationships with the actual troops like?
They were very good. I mean, it was like anything, really. You kind of chum up with a couple of people who were kind of kindred spirits. And, you know, they're very good. The military people are very good at looking after each other and also looking after outsiders. If they think you're okay, you know, then you can utterly rely on them. I can't think of any kind of, you know, political arguments or anything that any of the journalists have with them. Basically, both sides found each other quite fascinating. You know, they were as interested in us as we were of them, because we belonged to the way we did things was completely alien and counterintuitive to them. So they, you know, they're in a non-competitive, cooperative world, and, you know, hacks are the polar opposite of that. they thought what we did was quite fun, and we thought what they did was fun. So, yeah, there's kind of, you know, mutual respect, I think, and a lot of affection.
And you talk, too, as well, about the fact that they were very thoughtful. You've mentioned that already, that these were not people who were just the stereotypes that perhaps civilians consider them to be. How did that become apparent, the sort of thought that you talk about the officers quite a lot, and in fact you met Colonel H. Jones.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they were, you know, they were quite sceptical about the value of the exercise in terms of the justice of it, if you like. You know, they really didn't care too much about the rights and wrongs of the Falkland Islanders' claims. They didn't have any animosity particularly towards the Argentinians. You know, the fact it was a dictatorship and so forth was considered to be, well, you know, it's actually quite convenient that it's a dictatorship, because it means that, you know, our cause is therefore enhanced. But I don't think I ever heard anyone talk passionately about the, you know, the justice of the cause. There were also a certain amount of scepticism about Mrs. Thatcher. You know, she was very much an unknown quantity then. They weren't so crass as to think, you know, this is a woman sending us into war. I never heard any of that kind of talk. But, you know, again, it was the business of, there hadn't been any interesting soldiering for a long time. You know, Northern Ireland had settled down into this, you know, pretty dreary and quite dangerous policing work, essentially. And here you are with this, again, I use the word epic, but, you know, this incredible potential feat of arms. So all their training is going to be put to the test. They themselves are going to be put to the test, their skill and their courage. So, you know, there's a tremendous sort of buoyancy. Everyone was amazingly cheerful. The only people who weren't very cheerful were the MOD civilian minders, who I think had really not imagined that it was going to go all the way. And so as combat approached, I think, without being rude, too rude about them, there were different levels of enthusiasm or lack of enthusiasm, but I think certainly there were quite a lot of worried looks and long faces among the MOD types.
And what path did you follow across the Falklands? What was the route that you followed during the campaign?
Well, I landed on D-Day in San Carlos Water, so basically that's at the extreme end of East Falkland. And so it's about as far as everyone landed there, but it's about as far away as you can get from Port Stanley, the ultimate objective. And then thereafter, it was either a combination of walking and the helicopter trips. Some people yomped all the way from San Carlos to Teal Inlet, which is about a kind of 30 mile across. It doesn't sound very much 30 miles, but it's up and down, it was scree, bog, you know, it was absolutely knackering thing to do. The longest yomp I did was only about 5 or 6 miles.
And who did you do that with?
That was with the Marines. Right. But I went up to Mount Kent in a helicopter by night. They did a night sort of assault, and I went up with them on that. So yeah, most of the time you didn't, you know, you basically stayed put. You would take, you know, you got somewhere and then you stayed put. So it was a series of hops, but it was, the living conditions were pretty grim, because the army didn't take tents. Now, this is something I never got to the bottom of, and the closest I got to any kind of explanation was that it was kind of considered to be a bit sissy to be in a tent. So you were in this, you were meant to be able to live off the land by making your own bivvy, which meant digging a hole and stretching your poncho over it and sticking some rocks around the outside. And some of these guys were very good and made very elaborate bivvies, but, you know, us civilians were by no means as adept at it. But the other thing was that the water table in the Four Points is very, very high, so you've only got to stick your entrenching tool into the peat and immediately it fills up with water. So, you know, my enduring memory of it all has just been wet the whole time.
And, you know, you're with elite regiments here, Royal Marine Commandos, Parachute Regiment, you know, these are sort of top of the tree so far as the Navy and the Army go. Did you find it a struggle to keep up with them physically?
Well, I was a young man then, so it wasn't that difficult. It really wasn't. We were carrying quite a lot of weight with us, but you were none. There was this one epic yomp that a couple of journalists went on, but most of the time the distances were not that great. So yeah, I don't think I ever had any real difficulty. A couple of journalists went down with, you know, terrible colds and things, and just, I mean, that was the real danger was getting some sort of illness.
So it's more discomfort than anything else.
Yeah.
And did it change your mind about soldiers, having seen them in action? And I mean, what did you think of them?
Yeah, I think it actually had a probably changed my political outlook quite dramatically for a couple of reasons. One was the families of the soldiers. When we were leaving Southampton, on the Canberra, so I just got terribly confused about whether it was Southampton. No, it was Portsmouth. We left from Portsmouth. It was the QE2 that left from Southampton. Some of the families turned up at the dockside, and they were, you know, they just seemed to be a kind of part of Britain that had been brushed aside or was in the shadows or whatever. But they were
not
very
part
ordinary.
Of the metropolitan world.
Yeah, exactly. So they, you know, they were kind of almost an embarrassment. Because they were so straightforward and, you know, jolly and kind of patriotic. And this kind of thing was very, very much not the fashion at the time. And the combination of their kind of, you know, uncomplicated cheerfulness and the good nature and, you know, native intelligence of the military types kind of made me rethink some of my, you know, as you say, metropolitan sort of left of centre perceptions, which of course on the Observer it was the kind of religion was very much, you know, liberal left, and so thereafter I became more sceptical and more questioning of those sort of liberal preconceptions, it didn't actually tip me into being a kind of, you know, Thatcherite or anything, but it did make you, it's a good lesson in just taking nothing for granted.
And how did the campaign end for you?
I was with the commander, 14th commander on below Mount Harriet. I was at a first aid station, first aid post while they were assaulting the hill. And so I was there, you know, for the attack overnight. And then we just, you know, we yomped in from the top of Mount Harriet.
And by that point, the Argentinians had surrendered?
Yeah, well, I was up on the Mount Harriet when the first white flag started appearing in Stanley, so you could actually see it from Mount Harriet. It's only a couple of miles away, 5 or 6 miles away. And There was a bit of uncertainty, but then it was pretty, you know, it was clear that it had happened. So then we started, we moved forward. In fact, we got helicoptered forward a bit and then yomped the last bit. And, you know, the great question of who was first into Port Stanley, I mean, there's no doubt it was Max Hastings, but it was Max Hastings by about sort of 10 minutes or something. And so it wasn't this. So that caused a certain amount of aggro, it has to be said. You know, because it was a typical the way he'd run the whole campaign, that he was incredibly smart, really thought it out very, very carefully, and wrote terrific stuff. So, you know, he was undoubtedly, he deserved his laurels. But having sort of thwarted the competition at virtually every level, every day, it was just, it was too much for some of the colleagues.
Well, thank you, Patrick, for those insights. That's absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Patrick Bishop.
Thank you very much, Paul.
That's all for this month. You can read James Rom's piece on Alexander the Great, John Guy's essay on Thomas Becket, and Patrick Bishop's recollections of the Falklands War in the April edition of History Today, which is out now. You can also leave a comment or listen to previous editions by visiting www.historytoday.com/podcast.